This is the Lombardi Line on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Good afternoon on the East Coast. Good morning on the West Coast. He's Mike Palm. I'm Joe Serallo, and this is the Lombardi Line. Now, Mike and I had and still have a fun, exciting show planned for all of you. But it'd be remiss of us to not address the horrendous news of this morning right off the top. I'm sure most of us have all seen this news by now. If you haven't, late last night, Johnny Gaudreau, one of the most prolific young stars in the NHL, and his brother Matthew were bike riding in New Jersey ahead of their sister's wedding, which was supposed to be today. And they were both struck and killed by a drunk driver. All we know now is that the driver has been charged with two counts of DUI, two counts of death by auto. And this is just the most unimaginable situation for not only the Columbus Blue Jackets, Johnny's family, Johnny's sister. I mean, this is a kid who I mentioned he's one of the most prolific, incredible hockey players on the planet right now. Forget the talent. Forget the skill set. Forget whatever he did on the ice. This is a recipient of the league's Lady Byng Award, which goes to a player with the most upstanding character and sportsmanship. This is a kid who, you know, set all sorts of records at Boston College, becoming a true freshman, scoring in the national title game, just had a world of promise, a seven-time All-Star, most importantly, a son, a father of two small children, a husband, and a brother. This is just an absolutely abysmal situation, a horrific, horrifying situation for Johnny's family and his sister. I know I speak for Mike and for everyone at VSiN when we say that we send our condolences to the family, to his friends, to everyone who knew him and his brother, Matthew. Mike, this is certainly not what I anticipated starting the show with this morning when I woke up. Absolutely horrendous news.
Yeah, it's about as bad a news as you can get about somebody that's not a member of your own family, Joe. And I think about his wife and two young children first and foremost. But and what else? And I have three young children, and my thought was, you know, nobody's promised tomorrow. And here's a driver who'd been drinking who was trying to pass on the right. I mean, you have to be in such a hurry to go somewhere. And they tragically were in the wrong spot at the wrong time. So prayers go out to the Boston College community, to the Flames organization, and the community in Calgary, to the Blue Jacket organization, the community in Columbus, the entire community of the NHL, and of course, the Gaudreaus and their parents, their sister, and the entire family. And that's all we can do at this time.
Yeah, it's horrifying to think that today was supposed to be maybe the happiest day of his sister's life. And now instead of a wedding, she'll be burying two brothers. Mm. And the last thing I'll just say on this, folks, it's not hard. Take an Uber, call the damn Uber, call a cab, call a Lyft. It's really not hard. It's senseless, and there's no reason that this should have ever happened. But Mike, on that note, you know, like I said, we've got a busy show to get to today, only 2 hours together. And let's make the most of it, my man. College football, week one officially kicked off last night. I know you can't wait for tomorrow and for your Irish down there in College Station in Texas. But based on what we saw last night, what was your biggest takeaway? Obviously, all eyes were on Colorado and North Dakota State. And I mean, I've thought this for weeks, just, you know, 9.5 and then creeping its way up to 11.5. Mike, it was too many points for the Buffaloes.
Yeah, here's my biggest takeaway as a bettor is that Coach Prime still needs a lot of help with game management, especially at the end of halves and games. I thought they were atrocious in both. There was no reason for North Dakota State to ever get the ball back. You know, they're throwing the ball when North Dakota State was out of timeouts. You're right, the line did get away from them. It was a highly entertaining game, but I'd be cautious about Colorado moving forward. And, you know, for those that have made future bets on Shadur, whether it's for Heisman, which he's, you know, like sixth or seventh shortest in the market, or to be the first draft pick, I would tell you, you know, they're playing against an FCS defense there tonight. So just put that in perspective when you think about Shador in the future markets.
Yeah, and I will say Shador, you know, I like the first draft pick prop much more than him to win the Heisman, because to win the Heisman, you have to be on a good team. And frankly, I don't think Colorado is a good team, but I do think Shador looked phenomenal. I mean, 450 yards, whether it's, you know, a Power Five school or, you know, don't forget, this isn't your average FCS team, right, folks? It's like, you know, not your father's root beer. This isn't your father's FCS team. This is a team that's won 11 titles in the last 14 years, right? North Dakota State, South Dakota State, certain, and they're far and few between, but certain FCS programs command much more respect than the majority of their counterparts. And so I was frankly really impressed with how Shador looked, especially, Mike, because their offensive line stinks. And that's my biggest takeaway. Travis Hunter's a baller. We all know that. Shador Sanders could be the first pick. I mean, we would need to see this continue in Big 12 play. Although, let's be honest, outside of Utah, our Big 12 defense is much better than North Dakota State. I just think college football, once you get out of the SEC and the Big 10, defense is not a big part of the game, unfortunately. So I could see Shador being the number one pick, and I could see him being, you know, a fine NFL quarterback. I'm not going to prognosticate on his NFL career just yet. But right here, right now, in the year 2024, Colorado has problems because their defense can't stop a nosebleed and their offensive line has more holes than Swiss cheese. Very, very cliche problems I just listed right there for Colorado. But it's true. In the trenches, they're a disaster. I've been saying all summer leading up to the season, under 5.5 wins was what I liked. And frankly, that's because I thought North Dakota State was very live on the money line last night. And I've thought that for 6 weeks. And, you know, I mean, they covered that 11.5 point number with relative ease. It was just it was not a good showing for Colorado. I don't think it was smart scheduling for Colorado. Obviously, this stuff is done really far in advance. But that's not a great look. Even though they're the best FCS team of the past two decades, it's still not the way you want to start your season just squeaking by them.
Well, you don't have a lot to gain and a lot to lose if they should have lost that game at home at Boulder. The other problem right. for Colorado in the big picture is how deep the Big 12 is. I mean, this conference, if you, Joe, I said this, if you lined up 20 people that are sports bettors and you said Utah is going to be playing somebody in the Big 12 title game, who's it going to be? Legitimately, you could get 8 or 9 different answers out of 20 people. That is the deepest conference in the country by far. There are very few easy spots, and they're going to beat each other up. They might only be a one big lead, bid league because the second-place team might have 4 losses, but that's right. a tough road to hoe when you're looking at Colorado, looking up. I mean, you will see TCU against Stanford. Stormy's going to cover that game tonight, but legitimately moving up, West Virginia, Texas Tech, all the way up the board as you're looking at the odds if you're watching us on video, Arizona, Iowa State, Kansas, Houston, all of these teams have legitimate shots to be in the Big 12 title game, and the odds would suggest TCU too. I would draw the line after West Virginia, and we'll find out a lot about them against Penn State this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely, and I can't wait. Former Penn State Nittany Lion Justin King is going to join us in the next block. We'll get his thoughts on Penn State. Also, Travis Hunter, because a lot of people forget Justin King, his freshman year, played both ways for the Nittany Lions, something that's become a lost art in football. If we could pull up Colorado's schedule really quickly, I would appreciate that, guys, because, Mike, you talk about the depth of the Big 12 and how these cats are going to beat each other up, right? I mean, look at a team that was just 11-1 on the board. We had Arizona. I couldn't be higher on this Arizona Wildcats offense. Now, like I said, defenses in the Big 12, I think a lot of them have tremendous question marks attached. But, you know, you look at this Colorado schedule, and like I said, I had North Dakota State as very live on the money line in that one. Now they have to go to a Nebraska team that people are finally expecting this to be the year Nebraska finally regains some respect. Colorado State. Colorado won that game in Boulder a year ago. It was a really close one. Now they have to go on the road, and Colorado State is a much improved team that I think could be live to win the Mountain West. There are no gimmies on here. I think they should beat Baylor. Then they got to go to UCF. I don't like them in that game. I don't like them against Kansas State. I don't like them at Arizona. And then the last three games, frankly, I think Utah, Kansas, Oklahoma State, those are 3 losses. Mike, I really just do not see this team going over 5.5. And the fact that you can get plus money on the under, I think is a fantastic bet.
Yeah, if you told me, Mike, you have to bet exact number of wins for Colorado, I would bet 3 at this point. I think they should beat Baylor and Cincinnati at home. Where else do you think they're going to win? I don't find another spot on that schedule.
Yeah, I mean, at Texas Tech wouldn't shock me. It's going to be a shootout. We all know that. I mean, take the over in that game. And then, you know, maybe at Colorado State, you know, you're not wrong. I would probably say that they're going to be, they already have one win.
I think.
So are you saying three wins the rest of the way?
No, no, or? No. I'm saying two more wins. I think Colorado State.
Okay. I think they'll get three more.
I think Colorado State may be the second best team behind Boise in the Mountain West. I believe that.
Yeah.
I think they bring continuity back. They're one of the few teams that bring a quarterback and coach back. I mean, there's so much turnover at both quarterback and head coach in the Mountain West. So, and that's a big game. Nebraska will have revenge on their mind when they go into Lincoln and play in front of nearly 100,000 people. I mean, these are really tough spots for them to go to Central Florida. And the other teams they have at home are better than them. Kansas State is better than them. Utah is better than them. Oklahoma State was the hottest bet team to win the Big 12 that we had here. I mean, they went from 14-1 down to less than 6-1 at Circus. So I just think, now, could they win? Of course, they could win some of these other games. But what are they supposed to win? I think they're supposed to win two more games.
Yeah, and that's fair. If I had to put money on an exact number, I'll say that they've finished 4-8. But I mean, still, whether it's 3-9 or 4-8, to me, that's enough cushion to take that under 5.5, especially with some positive EV there and be pretty confident about it. Before we head to break, Mike, I got to give a quick shout out, by the way, to a good friend of mine's nephew, General Booty with Louisiana Monroe. You look at some of the other games last night, getting his first win as a starting quarterback in the FBS ranks. They beat Jackson State 30-14. I'm good friends with his Uncle Josh, former NFL quarterback, and his Uncle Jack as well. So shout out and congrats to my guy General Booty for his first win last night for the Warhawks. Guys, when we come back, Justin King joins the show. We're going to talk about this highly anticipated Penn State-West Virginia opener. More right here on the Lombardi Line. Back here on the Lombardi Line as we move it along on this Friday, August 30th. He's Mike Palm. I'm Joe Cirillo. And we're going to take you guys to the Progressive Guest Line nice and early in this one because I mentioned that huge Penn State-West Virginia opener. Who better to talk to about it than former Penn State D-back, former NFL D-back, and current host of the State of State podcast alongside Tom Hannifin. It's Justin King. Justin, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing great. Happy Friday. Thanks for having me, fellas.
Yeah, man, we're excited to have you on. This is, you know, obviously you've got Georgia, Clemson, and then you've got USC, LSU, Notre Dame, A&M. This game, I would say, between Penn State and West Virginia, right up there with those three, is one of the most highly anticipated of Week One. Even though West Virginia is not ranked, Justin, you know Morgantown is going to be absolutely rocking. It's the back end of a home and home between these two schools. Man, Penn State favored by over a touchdown. How do you feel about this team having to go into Morgantown to start the year?
Getting on the road to a hostile environment in any context of the season is a tough thing. And you have to be on guard, right? Coming out swinging and really ready to punch them in the mouth. Because the one thing about West Virginia as a football program, even though they're not ranked, they're always going to have great athletes and tough athletes. And from what I'm just hearing from the players and press conferences and alumni friends, they are extremely confident when they're playing home in Morgantown. So I think Penn State just has to come in ready to attack them and not play on their heels or try to let them give the game to them, because just it's a lot of excitement at the beginning of the season. But I think that's why it's such a highly anticipated game to start the season off with.
Justin, West Virginia came into that game last year with high hopes, and Penn State, I thought, really embarrassed them 38-15. They still had a decent year, but they bring Garrett Green back, and they're actually 12th in the nation in terms of returning offensive productivity. Talk to me about the Mountaineer offense and the challenges they will give the Nittany Lion defense tomorrow.
I mean, they have two strong running backs, right? And the way that they attack the football, I mean, at least they did the way they did last year, was really a physical approach. Last year, they showed a little bit of a little blueprint on how to attack Penn State's defense, was right up the middle and attacking them. And I think when they were able to do that, they were able to move the ball up and down the field. Because, I mean, there's one thing where the score was what it was, but, I mean, even from the Penn State fan base and ecosystem, they were not impressed by the win because they felt that it was a much closer game than maybe the score indicated. So, I mean, just the physical nature in which they play, I think on the outside, Penn State had the upper hand when it just came to the athletes. I mean, but now you add that emotional aspect of playing the opening season or the opening game of the season with some of those key factors of older West Virginia team and some new starters at Penn State, I think, man, it becomes a little bit of a toss-up in the sense of you got to come out and ready to play, because it can be a tough road playing West Virginia at home.
You know, Justin, you mentioned the emotional aspect there. Emotions are something I want to see a little more from Drew Aller, right? I always say this kid's got the talent, but if he had 1/10 of the swag of a Sean Clifford or a Trace McSorley, I'd almost say he'd certainly be the best quarterback in Penn State history. What do you see from Drew Aller this year? What have you seen in the offseason that might make you think he's ready to take the next step up from last year, where at times he left a little something to be desired?
My main thing is a highly talented quarterback. Anytime you see the growth of an athlete, I think you have to have a little bit of perspective and patience, right? I think when we look at some of the top first-round draft picks last year, you would have never thought they were going to be first-round draft picks if you went back to their freshman and sophomore years, whether it's a Bo Nix or even Jaden Daniels, right? So like, when you think about just the time, when you think about this time and snap count that it takes for a quarterback to feel confident to where their emotion can come out, right? Like, if you're processing and thinking about operating offense and not giving up anything from that standpoint, you're not fully yourself. So it just takes time, and that rep count, we always like to see when we talk about quarterbacks and their success in the NFL, the one stat that's never really spoken about is their snap count. We talk about fact patterns of reading defenses, and when you have to have some time under your belt for that to be second nature, for your emotions to come out. So sometimes we got, spoiled with Sean Clifford and Trace McSorley, guys that were in the program for a long time, so we finally seen their emotions come out. So I think it's just a level of perspective and patience. I mean, for a guy to throw 28 touchdowns and 2 picks last year, I mean, I think this is a nice floor to grow on.
Dustin, this question may hit a little close to home, so I'm going to ask for forgiveness before I even say it, but I know your family involved with coaching your stepdad under James Franklin. Talk to me whether you think the rap about James Franklin can't win the big game is fair. I mean, 4-16 against the Big Two, Michigan and Ohio State, 3-17 all time against top 10 teams. Is that a fair rap on James Franklin?
I think anytime that you get into coaching evaluations, which is what my business does with LIG Sports Group as a sports advisory, I think it's very nuanced and it's contextual, right? Because I think you got to remember the first 3-4 years when he got to Penn State and the roster that he was dealing with, the sanctions and everything that came with. Like those losses, you know, I mean, when they weren't expected to win, like, they're still on his record when you talk about top team performance. So I would look at that as, I mean, it's a mark to say, like, in those big games, you have to perform and get over the hump. But I don't think, when you look at the top coaches in the country, none of them are extremely successful besides Kirby Smart against other top level coaches, right? They all have a pretty much inverted ratio of wins. So when it comes to that, contextually, where Penn State has come from, I think we lose what sanctions and how bad the sanctions were when they got there. I had the opportunity to see what the roster and what the makeup was when we got there before we recruited guys like Miles Sanders, Michael Parsons, and everything kind of matriculated to where it is now. So that's from 2018. We're talking 6 years later. I think the record is what it is, so it has to get better and perform at that level. But also, there's some context into that when you think of the program that he took over. But yes, you have to make that next step over and make the big W's and get into the playoffs and get to somewhere, you know. Can't say that Penn State's never been, because by the numbers, he has won and done things in a time period that has never happened at Penn State.
So then, looking at the schedule this year, right? Ohio State, obviously the biggest game on there. Some other tough ones, you know, having to go to USC, I think certainly winnable. You know, Wisconsin, certainly winnable. Do you think this team has it in them? And obviously, you know, look, we haven't seen them play a single game yet, so we've got to see a little something. But does this team have it in them not just to make the newly expanded playoffs, which they should, frankly, make, but to overtake Ohio State and maybe earn a spot in that Big Ten championship game?
I think there's a lot of question marks with that incomplete. I mean, that whole scenario, right? I think there's a lot of question marks when you think about the outside receivers and just guys stepping up. If Drew's going to make that next step as a quarterback, I think those different aspects going in the secondary. Abdul Carter, I mean, moving down to defensive end. There's a lot of holes to fill in, but I think from the baseline of where they were and, like, that growth, they had a young team, and, like, all those guys were a little bit older, and a lot of guys that had experience and also still having depth. They did a great job in the transfer portal. So I think they have the ability, but I think the makeup of the team in this new Big Ten and this new college era of, I mean, college athletics is going to be on display this year. So it's hard to say, but I think they have the ability. And I also feel if any team can get deep into the playoffs this year, it should be Penn State.
Dustin, I want to ask you about the effect of NIL from a decision-making perspective of the college athlete. You declared after your junior year, which was a little bit of a controversial decision, but did great in the combine, got drafted in the fourth round. How thin will the drafts get in the future? And I'm talking about beyond maybe the third round, when kids can stay in school and make more money than they might make in the pros.
I think it's a viable option, right? And I think you'll see more and more guys choose to come back and play that extra year. Now, I think it depends on what your contract value is and what position you play as well, right? This is just, I mean, whether you're a running back, I think it's completely different than if you're a corner versus, you know, where you're getting drafted. So a lot of nuance in that. But just from the overall standpoint, I think a lot of guys will come back to college for that standpoint. I know from my own personal story, like I left because, I mean, I was like to say searching development, but there was a level of, you know, thinking that, okay, I can leave and I can make this next step from like a contract value. So it's all about everyone's individual process. Like that's like going through the recruiting process. There's some players that the NIL is a little bit higher than the fit and the opportunity to play early, right? So it's all about where it fits in from the individual player. But I think overall, we'll see more players decide to stay back in school.
Justin, this has been tremendous stuff, man. I want one more opinion from you in the final 30 seconds here, if you could. Travis Hunter, superstar, playing both ways. A lot of people don't know or don't remember you played both ways your freshman year at Penn State. Is this sustainable? And should we look at Travis Hunter as someone to maybe buck the trend of only quarterbacks winning the Heisman Trophy? Is he live for that award?
I think he's definitely alive for the award. And I just want to give a shout out to the guys that have done it before, whether it was like Key Tlaib, who had made a splash on both sides. We think of Champ Bailey back in the day. And we think of obviously Charles Woodson, who won the Heisman Trophy. But I think he falls into the line of those types of players. But eventually you have to play one side of the football.
Justin, thank you so much for the time, man. Really appreciate it. I want to continue this conversation as the season rolls on. And folks, make sure you check out State of State.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Justin. How about Gordy Lockbaum?
Absolutely.
No Gordy Lockbaum?
Ooh, Mike dropping an old school reference on us. Lombardi Line rolls on right after the break. Back here on the Lombardi Line, he's Mike Palm. I'm Joe Cirillo with you on this Friday morning, Friday afternoon, depending on where you're either watching or listening to the program. And I want to remind you of all the places that you can watch and listen to the program, because of course you can do it over at VSiN.com, but also YouTube TV and the iHeartRadio app. You can even tell Alexa, Alexa, play VSiN on the iHeartRadio app. So make sure that you're locked in, be it audio or video, to the program and to the network at all times. Mike, we finally have an end to ultimately what has been the long and unnecessary drama surrounding Brandon Ayuk and the 49ers. Ayuk and the Niners settle on a four-year, $120 million deal with $76 million in guarantees. I believe, frankly, given some of the other contracts we've seen handed out, a fair deal for both sides. You know, I think this is a better deal for the Niners than, you know, Jalen Waddle's deal for the Dolphins. I think a guy like Ayuk is head and shoulders above Waddle and some other receivers who have just gotten their payday. But this deal almost didn't happen. Apparently, Mike, reports are saying that the Denver Broncos were the holdup in a three-way deal that would have actually sent Ayuk to Pittsburgh, that San Fran and Pittsburgh were both in agreement upon. It was just Denver as the third wheel, if you will, that stopped that deal from going through. So now that Ayuk is back with the Niners, what do you think of the extension, Mike? What do you think of how this will impact San Fran early on in the season, given that Ayuk has been a holdout?
Well, it's interesting in that the pay scale, and you look at the guys that got the four-year deals, right? And in descending order, Jefferson gets 140, CeeDee gets 136, and Ayuk and Amon-Ra St. Brown basically both get 120. I think he got a pretty good deal. If we're being honest with ourselves, in terms of the value that those other three guys have to that offense. He's one of pieces, right, in San Francisco. It's hard when you have that many weapons offensively, and you got to, you know, you're still with Purdy under the rookie contract. You're able to do that, but to keep everybody happy. I mean, when you look at Dallas, CeeDee Lamb, there's an 1,100-yard drop-off from CeeDee Lamb to the next most productive receiver. Right. So I think, yes, I think both sides are happy. I think Brandon Ayuk did almost everything he could not to be in San Francisco, but ultimately he got paid. And if you're a 49ers fan, I think you're breathing a sigh of relief today that at least they're going to take their best shot at trying to run this back again, although the schedule is brutal, and I think there are other teams in the NFC, particularly in the North, that have made up ground on them talent-wise.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you on San Francisco not being head and shoulders above their competition like they were a season ago. As far as Ayuk, first off, I'll say, you know, I've been saying this since July. I was dying to see him go to Pittsburgh. I've got my Steelers over 8.5 win ticket plus $1.20. And I think that Ayuk going there would have really solidified that offense, which I think will be exciting with Arthur Smith now as the offensive coordinator. Mike, you and I could have been better OCs than Matt Canada was. But with Arthur Smith there, look, I've said this for a while. Arthur Smith was not meant to be a head coach. Some people just aren't. Cliff Kingsbury, perfect example of that. Not meant to be a head coach. I think Arthur Smith was meant to be an offensive coordinator. And, you know, we won't get to see it, at least not in the near future. But Ayuk there would have been a lot of fun. I do think he is slightly more important to the San Francisco 49ers offense than maybe everyone's giving him credit for. And the reason I say that is because at first, Mike, my reaction was identical to yours. At first, I said, well, you know, Kyle Shanahan and that Niners offense, you can just plug and play and mix and match, and he'll make anyone a star because of his system. And then I thought about it. And obviously, you get a lot of versatility with Christian McCaffrey and what he can do both in the run game and as a pass catcher when called upon. Deebo Samuel gives you a lot of versatility, kind of opposite McCaffrey as a pass catcher first, but then also a guy who, when called upon, can positively impact your ground game. But Deebo is more of the kind of guy you want to hit 5 yards out, give him some space to work with, and let him create. What I've seen from Brandon Ayuk, and I feel like he's been around the league a long time. He's only been in there 4 years. What I've seen out of him is constant growth and constant improvement. Absolutely zero complacency. You've seen a tremendous uptick in his numbers, and at times with a very questionable quarterback situation, in each of his 4 years in the league. And to me, that is as green a flag as exists when you're looking at a young professional football player, especially a young wide receiver. You haven't seen a plateau in Brandon Ayuk's numbers. You've seen improvement in his route running, right? When he came into the league, he was considered an all or nothing, you know, strictly go route deep ball threat. You've seen a guy who's become a much better route runner, a guy who has also grown as a blocker. He's one of the better blocking receivers in the NFL, much like Amon-Ra St. Brown. And who Amon-Ra St. Brown might be my favorite receiver in the league. What that tells me about a receiver, when you're as talented as a St. Brown, as an Ayuk, and you're also a great blocker, that tells me you're a team guy. And that might get lost in the contract, you know, shuffle and contract debate. But if he's willing to put his body out there so that McCaffrey can work an end around or Deebo can work an end around and get 30 yards, that tells me you're a team guy. I think this was important for San Francisco to lock him up. Now, the tricky part, of course, is that San Francisco is going to have to pay Brock Purdy eventually, or say we'll plug and play a new quarterback. They have offensive line questions. Trent Williams is going to want a contract. And after Trent Williams, the offensive line, frankly, has some serious concerns. So now, you know, San Francisco has to ask themselves what they're going to do about the contract, about their salary situation moving forward. But I think Ayuk was a pretty necessary guy to retain if you actually want to win a Super Bowl.
Joe, let me ask you, did you make the Steelers bet in anticipation that you thought it was likely that Ayuk was going there?
No, I made that Steelers bet regardless, and I just would have felt a lot better about my value if Ayuk had gone there, because I think that plus $1.20, $1.25 that you can shop around and get, I think that would probably work its way into, you know, a minus 110, minus 115 number after the trade.
You know, the biggest hold-in, hold-out story that's probably getting the least attention is Chase in Cincinnati. And maybe
absolutely.
Maybe I have the perspective, because it's the only team I made a Super Bowl bet on was actually the Bengals. But, I mean, this is not good. Nobody's reporting. Now he practices. Now he's out again. And the other thing more globally is all these holdouts. I mean, this has like early season hamstring injuries written all over them.
Yeah. Yeah, I could absolutely see that. And, you know, I mean, with Chase, too, I think he's a little more fragile than Ayuk. And he's shown that, you know, throughout the course of the last three, four seasons. But yeah, with Ayuk in this situation, obviously, you got to hope he stays healthy. If you're the Niners, you need him to stay healthy. I'm curious about this impact. Mike, we've seen some serious line movement in that week one Monday night game between the Niners and the Jets. Opened at San Fran -5.5, now down to -3.5. So I wonder how much that number, I would have to imagine that that's almost entirely had to do with this Ayuk situation. Maybe a little bit with the offensive line as well. But how do you think now that he's back and he's obviously going to play and be in a 49er, do you expect to see movement on that number back in the opposite direction?
I think 4 is as far as it's going to go back, Joe, just because I think there's a lot of Jets love. I really do. Yeah. I had my panel last weekend. The two teams everybody was consensus high on were Jets and Lions. The thought is, you know, if Rodgers had the last season he had in Green Bay, which I'm not sure that that's that likely, but if he could transpose that onto this Jets team, who won 7 games the last 2 years with the worst quarterback play in the league, you know, that they can be really good. Now, the schedulers did Rodgers no favors. They open at San Francisco on a Monday night, obviously, right? A really tough spot.
But it gets easy after that, Mike.
It does. It does. But I think the movement is probably half baked into Ayuk and Trent, and then the other half baked into the thoughts on the Jets in the market. So I don't think it gets to 4.5. I think there'd be too much resistance, but I wouldn't be surprised if it closes 4.
Yeah, personally, I mean, I'm pretty all in on San Fran, and I like the Jets. I think the Jets win the AFC East, but in this game, I'm pretty all in on San Francisco. Rodgers has struggled immensely with the 49ers over the past half decade, especially when he has to go to San Fran. He's flat out stunk. You know, be it losing at Lambeau to a 6-seed Niner team or going there in a conference championship game and getting his doors blown off in a game where Jimmy Garoppolo only attempts 8 passes. Rodgers has really struggled with this team, but it's funny because when you look at the Jets in the AFC East, I think the way to handicap the Jets is picture Tyrod Taylor has to play quarterback for maybe even half the season. I'm not saying it's a guarantee, but if you really want to fairly assess the Jets, think about what their floor is with Tyrod Taylor. I still think they're a 9-win team with Tyrod Taylor, Mike. It's all about the defense for me. This could be the best defense in football this year for the Jets.
Joe, you're a New York guy. Is Tyrod Taylor more a positive going to the Jets for the Jets or more a negative not being on the Giants, hurting the Giants?
Yeah, I hate that loss. I mean, we'll see what Drew Locke, because I'm a Giants fan, right? We'll see what Drew Locke could do. I hate to say when. I'll say if called upon, but that it might be when called upon. I mean, that's just where Giants fans are at. No, I think Tyrod Taylor's as good a backup quarterback as exists in this league. And with that defense, you know, they probably wouldn't win the division if Rodgers went down, but they'd be very in the wild card hunt with Tyrod Taylor. I just think that pass rush is ferocious and that secondary is only going to be even better because of that pass rush. When we come back, we're going to look at today's baseball slate. We've already got a game underway. We'll fill you in on the other side. Don't go anywhere. It's the Lombardi Line. Back here on the Lombardi Line as we get ready to wrap up hour number one. He's Mike Palm. I'm Joe Cirillo. A lot of great football discussion. I mean, hey, guys, it's week one of the college football season. The NFL season is less than a week away from kicking off. But baseball is still coming down to the home stretch here. And, you know, that's my sport. I know Mike is also a big baseball guy. We got to carve out some time for a Friday where there's not 15 games, folks, but 16 games on the schedule. And the Milwaukee Brewers are threatening. Colin Ray got touched up early in game one of that doubleheader out in Cincinnati. It was 3-1 Reds, now 3-2 Milwaukee, top of the fourth, currently have second and third with 2 outs. So we'll keep y'all updated to see what Frelick can do here against Nick Martinez as he just took an 88 mile per hour cutter right down Broadway that he probably could have done something with for strike one of that at bat. Mike, busy slate to come. The rest of the 15 games all starting at 6:40 p.m. Eastern time or later. So all night games, we still have a long time to get those bets in. What jumps out to you on this docket today?
You know, it's a matchup of two of my favorite pitchers in the whole game. Maybe they're my favorite two this year in Houston today. And boy, the Houston Astros just keep coming up with young pitchers. This Hunter Brown really has started to develop. Was terrific last night in the first of a very important four-game series between the Astros and the Royals. Look, I love Seth Lugo when he was with your Mets. I thought they totally mismanaged the first half of his career. He was a seventh-inning guy. He was an eighth-inning guy. No, he's a starter. No, he's a closer. No, he's a start. He was like what they used to do with Kenta Maeda with the Dodgers, except he was able to do it a little more fluidly. And then when he went to the Padres, I said, now they're going to make him a starter. He's going to do great. Very disappointing year last year. He moves to the American League with the Royals, and I thought he was really overpriced or underpriced, as you would say, in the Cy Young market. When his, you know, he's been one or two in innings pitched all year, which is part of the problem. But, you know, before the All-Star break, I believe it was late May, maybe the first week of June, I got him at 40-1 for Cy Young. You know, the rumors were out there about Skubal. I thought if Skubal goes to the Dodgers, he goes to the National League, then it becomes Burns and Lugo in a race. I wasn't counting on Clase from Cleveland, you know, putting his nose into the race. But anyhow, look, Lugo for four starts now has a dead arm. I've been saying this for a month. They should have put him on the 10-day IL. Let him freshen that arm back up. That start in Minnesota, where every inning they battered him. He wins against the Angels, but it was the Angels. I think he's in a really tough spot tonight. And meanwhile, Framber, who was on the the injured list twice earlier in the year, struggled at the start. I mean, he had an ERA of 4.5, I believe, in the second week of June. His ERA all the way down to 3.27. He almost threw another no-hitter again. I know he lost one game in Baltimore during this stretch, 3-2. But he, if the season started June 1st, he might be your leader in the Cy Young balloting. So I played the Astros on the run line tonight at plus 134. I think they're going to get to Lugo. Framber's not going to get beat up there. Yeah, if you told me the Royals scored three runs, I still like the Astros because I don't think Lugo can get through five. I don't think Lugo can give up less than five earned. So Astros, I would even look if it's available at alternate run lines and look at lane 2.5 with them tonight.
Wow. The only thing, Mike, that's incredibly risky there, of course, is the Astros are the home team. So, you know, if they are up one, if they are up two and you were to go the alt line, you know, they wouldn't get that those last licks in the bottom of the ninth. You could be working with 24 outs.
Yeah, that's why you always get a little better price. In general, I get what you're saying in general. But I'm counting on, I would even do something, you know, and look at these alt markets, do something, lay a run and a half in the first five, where you do get all the at bats and you're going to get your 15 outs against Lugo.
Yeah. I think that's a good market to look at. I actually hit that first five run line yesterday, with the Rangers and the White Sox in that game with Eovaldi going, and it worked out. The White Sox hit a home run in the bottom of the ninth to make it 2-1. If I had gone the full game run line, it's a loser. Real quick, because you mentioned Framber Valdez, you know, having a shaky first 6 to 8 weeks of the year. And then since June 1st, being a Cy Young favorite, how about his teammate, Mike, Hunter Brown, since May 18th? So we're not talking about a small sample size anymore. We're talking 3.5 months. Hunter Brown is 10-3 with a 2.13 ERA. I mean, he had, talk about an atrocious April. That ERA was over 9. You know, after April, 7.71 the ERA was halfway through May. Since then, 10-3 with a 2.1. And it makes sense. The Astros have the best record in baseball, I believe, since May 30th. So all of that stuff certainly checks out with Valdez and Brown, because that starting pitching rotation has just been decimated with injuries. I mentioned briefly there that White Sox run line, the first five run line I had yesterday on Texas. Mike, I'm going full game run line on my Mets today, laying the run and a half as they go to the south side. Jonathan Cannon going for the White Sox in this one. He's lost on the run line in 8 of 15 starts this year. The White Sox have lost those by multiple runs. Tylor Megill. Now, this is a really interesting pitcher, Mike, because I don't think his stats accurately reflect his stuff. What we've seen from Megill oftentimes is 4-5 lights out innings, and then he gets left in too long, kind of like Seth Lugo as of late. And he gets left in too long, and then he implodes later on in the game. So if we can get a dominant five from Megill and hand it off to the bullpen, tattoo Cannon for a few runs, I like the direction the Mets are going in. We talked about it, you know, Six wins in their last 10 against the O's, the Padres, and the D-backs. So I'll lay the $1.35 with the Mets on the run line there, Mike. What are your thoughts on that play?
Well, the White Sox are only 73 games below 500. So everybody tweeted out those pictures of 30 people being at the stands for the restart. Well, you know, that's a little disingenuous because the people that got in that game were the ones that had tickets from the nights before. But still, it is god-awful. It's god-awful to listen to them and John Schriffen as well. I continue to mention that because I talk about being tone-deaf. I've been a little bit disappointed in Tyler Mahgill, but it's a short sample size off the injury, obviously. I think the Mets get a lot of class relief here, if you were talking in horse racing terms, after coming through that gauntlet that they've been through, and now they get to go into Chicago here. And, you know, you talk about Josh Towers, who used to be regular on the network, would talk about when you go and play a bad team, and it used to be like Brandon Hyde's Orioles a few years ago, when you would go and play the Orioles for three games, bet against that team after the Orioles series because they get lazy habits playing against a really bad team. But how about when you have to play against really good teams and you sharpen yourself? So I think this is a big weekend for the Mets to try to make up some ground in the wild card race.
Absolutely. The Braves got the Phillies. They blew one yesterday. They were up 5-0, lost 6-5. So if there's a time for the Mets to try to make up ground on Atlanta, it certainly starts right now after staying afloat, I'll say, throughout their last 10. Mike, I've got two more best bets I want to get to. First, it's the Nerfy in D.C., Cubs, Nationals, Imanaga, Jake Irvin on the bump. Washington, over 81% on the Nerfy this year, the most Nerfy-prone team in baseball. Cubs, eighth most at over 73%. I love Imanaga in this matchup. And the Cubs' top of the lineup just tends to start slow. So even though Jake Irvin has regressed from what was, you know, a great season he was putting together through July 4th, since the 4th of July, he's frankly stunk with an ERA over 5. But like I said, the Cubs don't really hit too often too early. And so I'll go with the Nerfy there at a fair price. And then those Orioles you just mentioned, I'm going to take them on the first 5 money line, only minus 130 in Colorado. And obviously Colorado is a place where weird, funky things happen on a seemingly a daily basis when the Rockies are home. But Albert Suarez has been lights out since rejoining the rotation on August 6th. 4 starts, 23 and a third innings pitched. He's allowed just 2 earned runs. He had 3 straight scoreless outings until he gave up 2 to the Astros last time out. That's a 0.77 ERA for his last 4 games started. He's going up against Austin Gomber for the Rockies, who talk about a sample size. His last 15 starts has an ERA north of 6. The Orioles also have the 6th highest OPS against lefties and the most home runs against lefties in baseball this season. So laying $1.30 on the first 5 money line is more than a fair price. I'm actually surprised it's a shorter price than the full game money line. I was expecting it to be around minus 150, so I think it's tremendous value. Mike, you tailing or fading either of those two bets?
I haven't made them, Joe, but I've been an anti-Gomber guy for a long time. I've never liked Gomber. I'll tell you the other play that I do have in pocket. This is a game people might say, well, this is the best pitching matchup of the day. Although some will look to the desert and say Kershaw-Gallen's a very interesting game tonight. But Kevin Gausman against Pablo Lopez. Mm-hmm. I played the Jays tonight, plus 137. I firmly believe that Pablo Lopez heads a class of pitchers in Major League Baseball I call fake aces. They are the supposed ace of their staff here. You can get a better line at DraftKings. The number's moving against a plus 145 with the Jays. I'm going to fade Lopez and the Twins tonight. They are struggling right now.
Yeah, they're struggling. The Blue Jays are all of a sudden a frisky team. You know, they're out of it. They're playing loosey-goosey with no pressure. I was on him last night against Boston. Bowden Francis has been a freaking heart attack. Mike, I love it. I think it's a great call there with Gausman against Lopez and his ERA well north of 4. Guys, hour 2 of the Lombardi line after the break.